Good evening. My name is Paul, and I'm a very sensitive alcoholic. Thank you, Warren, for the introduction. It was very nice. A little bit short, but... I'm very sensitive, and I'm very humble. I really am. Dale was talking last night. He was very proud of his humility, and I share his feeling. I too. Thank you, sir. I too am proud of my humility. In fact, there was a fellow was talking one day to the audience, and he was telling people how humble I was, and I really appreciated his comments. Because I'll tell you, there's just, as Hale will confirm, I'm sure, there's just nothing more boring than being humble and not having anybody notice it. It's a real drag. Oh, I'm glad to be here. Alcoholics always say that. They're glad to be anywhere. I want to thank Joan and the committee and all the people that had anything to do with us being here. We're glad to be having you. And I have to say something about Warren and Terry picking us up. You always have to be particularly kind to the people you hope are going to give you a ride back to the airport. But one of the things, I've never been to a place that a convention has been more, a more beautiful area. And yet I'm not sure which is more beautiful, the area or the people. The people, you guys are very friendly, very warm, and very helpful, and we really appreciate that. You're exceptional. You may not know that, but give yourselves a big hand, as a matter of fact. You deserve that. And there's been several comments about the Al-Anons being here. I just wonder how many, I know there are Al-Anons in the audience. I can feel the vibrations. I personally love Al-Anon. I go to Al-Anon meeting every Monday noon in Laguna Beach, and I've been going for years. And I think Al-Anon's got really good stuff. And one of the one of the most common problems I run into is dealing with somebody who their main problem is that they're trying to live comfortably in a relationship with another alcoholic, and they'll go on and on and on about how awful it is, and I say, well, that's a 110% Al-Anon problem. Why don't you go to Al-Anon? And they're insulted. And here they are in what I considered the bottom of the social barrel when I came in, and they're insulted that somebody should tell them to go to Al-Anon. And I love Al-Anon. I think I really enjoy it. I'd like to see the hands of all the Al-Anons. Will all the Al-Anons raise your hand? Don't be ashamed now. Put your hand up. Good, I should too. Yeah, give them a big hand. What about the people in their first year of sobriety? Can we see the hands of everybody in their first year? Oh, wow. Good. We're always glad to see the newcomers. Bill W., one of the co-founders of Alcoholics Anonymous, said that carrying the message of recovery was our primary aim and the chief reason for our existence. And the primary aim and chief reason for our existence, those are pretty strong words. And when he says our existence, does he mean us as individuals, or us as groups, or both? But there's nothing more important we can do than carrying the message of recovery. And we carry it to each other because it pays to keep each other sober. But it's a lot of fun to carry it to the newcomers because it's fun to see what happens to newcomers. I always said that even if AA wouldn't keep me sober, I'd keep coming back to meetings just to see what happens to the newcomers. it's great to see the light come on and the whole family get well. So we're really glad you're here. In fact, we're so glad you're here, we don't care that you're not glad you're here. In fact, if you're really happy to be here, if you're happy to be here, we may not be able to help you. But if you can think of 1,000 places you'd rather be, and you think this whole thing is extremely corny, and especially if you think your case is different. Sad news, that makes you one of us. And so keep coming back. You may learn to like it. As a matter of fact, that's one of the things I like about AA. They don't charge any extra if you enjoy it. So you might as well enjoy it. One thing I haven't heard at this convention this weekend is I haven't heard anything about getting your court card signed, your get well nudge from the judge. I don't know if you do that much up here in Oregon or not. Yeah, you do? It's not part of AA, but we do it as a service to the courts, I guess. I'm always reminded of, I was talking in Riverside, California one night, and apparently the meeting place must have been close to a courthouse or something. When you were waiting to talk at that meeting, you sit up at the front at a table up there with the officers of the meeting and wait till you're called on. And they had a basket there with the court cards had been deposited in. Not having anything better to do, I counted the court cards, and there were 21 court cards at that meeting. But only one newcomer. So I've kind of gotten in the habit of welcoming the non-alcoholic drunk drivers. We're really glad you're here. I personally hope you stay here till I get back to the airport. Anyway, Christy asked me, she said, you still get nervous when you're going to talk. And I said, well, I don't call it nervousness. I'd rather call it anticipatory anxiety. Sounds a little nicer. And besides, before I'm going to talk, I say the third step prayer. I love the third step prayer, and I say that a lot. In fact, in the morning, before I'm fully awake, I'll say the serenity prayer, third step prayer, and the seventh step prayer. And then at breakfast, Max and I'll say those three prayers, and then we do some reading, mainly from Ellen on literature at that time. And then I talk to God out loud, and then she talks to her higher power out loud, and we get to know each other, she and I, better, and all that. And it's a nice form of intimacy. And then throughout the day, if I have any free time, don't have anything to do, or if I'm going to do something I'm apprehensive about, I will say the third step prayer, which says, God, I offer myself to Thee, to build with me, and to do with me as You wish. Relieve me of the bondage of self, that I may better do Thy will, and so on. But I modify it. I'll say, God, I offer myself and this situation to You to do with as You wish. And when I'm going to talk, I'll say, God, I offer myself and this situation to You to do with as You wish. Now, I would like it to turn out phenomenally successfully. But if you have it in your mind that this is the time for me to make a complete ass of myself, Well, at least one of us will have a good time. You know? This may be the night. And so that's the way that goes. I guess I really should be talking. I should talk something about alcohol. Before I do that, I want to say something. I want to talk about something that I don't talk about hardly ever. But Warren mentioned my story in the book, and I don't know why I don't why I feel uncomfortable talking about it, but I do, because I don't know, it just seems like it's something you shouldn't talk about. It should be an anonymous story in the thing. So my name on the story in the book, the only name in the story in the book is Max's name, not mine. And she loves to point that out. I've heard it here this weekend a lot, where people come up and ask me if it's true that what they've heard, that I've decided I don't want this in the book, or I don't want that in the book. I'm sorry, there's so much about drugs in the book, or I want to take out There's No Mistakes in God's World, or I'm sorry I ever wrote the book, or I changed my mind about acceptance, or that I've been loaded on pills, or I've gotten drunk, or, you know, even the fact that I've died. All of those are not true. You know? In fact, I agree with what's written there now more than when I wrote it. And people ask how I got, they often say, how did you get your story in the book? How did you get your story in the book, is the way they often say. I usually say, oh, I gave them a lot of money. You know, I'll try to tell you as briefly as I can. I sent articles into the grapevine, and the most recent one was No Pills to Alcoholics. It was an article why doctors shouldn't prescribe tranquilizers and such pills to alcoholics. When you write a letter for the grapevine, they'll write you a letter back and tell you what a wonderful article it is, and then they'll tell you whether they're going to use it or not. I got the letter back. She said they liked the story, and they were going to use it. And then at the bottom, she said, had I perchance ever had a dual problem, meaning both drugs and alcohol? And if so, had I ever written the story up, and would I consider submitting it for possible inclusion in the next edition of the big book? I was very embarrassed to read that. I didn't even answer it. I had no intentions of writing it. I thought if I wrote it, people would all read it, and I'd have nothing to say at meetings. I don't remember what all I thought. They were all very humble reasons, though. And so I didn't answer there. So she called from New York and wanted to know where it was. I lied and I said I hadn't had time. She said, I'll extend the time. So she extended the time a couple of times, and I had no intention of writing it. And then finally, the other girl at the office, other than Max, was a medical transcriptionist. She was on the program. She says, she thought it'd be nice if she typed up a story, which later on appeared in the book. She says, why don't you write it? I'll type it. We'll send it in. I said, okay. I wrote it, she typed it, we sent it in, and they wrote back and said it was too late. They had another printing instead of another edition. I thought, that's good, that's the last I'll hear of it. She says, no, we'll put it in the grapevine. They put it in the grapevine, and this is the only key I have as to really why they wanted it. They put it in the grapevine, and the story in the grapevine was exactly as I had written it, but they changed, then the title was the same, Bronze Moccasins. If you're here today, you heard Max say, for my seventh birthday, she had my moccasins, the ones I made in the nut ward, she had them bronze. But when they put the story in the book, they changed it to Dr. Addict Alcoholic. And I think that's the only clue I have as to why they wanted it. I think they wanted to show that you could be an alcoholic and still be an addict, but that didn't make you not an alcoholic. And if you could be a doctor, it surprised me to find out you could be a doctor and be an alcoholic. But apparently, you could do that too. So, so that's how it got in there. And I don't know why I told you that story. But I get tired of hearing people say that I've changed my mind about it, or that I didn't believe that anymore. In fact, somebody even wrote to Colorado, from Colorado, wrote to New York and said that he had heard that the author of that story had recanted his story. Now, I hadn't heard the word recanted since Martin Luther. He said had recanted his story and no longer believed that AA was the answer to staying sober. And he wrote into New York and wanted to know if that was true. And if it was true, what did he now think was the answer to that? Which I thought was a nice question to ask AA. But anyhow, so anyway, that's the story of how the thing got in the book. And I agree with all of it better today than I ever did then. Anyway, I used to drink. That's what I need to talk about. I have a bit of a cough and sore throat. That's why I'm sucking on this. And I'm not eating candy while I'm up here. I used to drink. Of course I drank. We live in a drinking society. Everybody drinks. I mean, you can't be a doctor and not drink, for God's sake, because all those parties to go to and stuff. And but I wasn't one of those dumb alcoholics. I did have a lot of morning sickness, though. that wasn't because I was an alcoholic. That was because I drank on an empty stomach. Should never drink on an empty stomach. So I was very careful not to drink on an empty stomach. And I still got sick in the morning. And I found out that was because I'd mixed my booze. Should never mix your booze. And then I got sick. I hadn't mixed my booze and hadn't drunk on an empty stomach and I got sick. That was because I got some bad booze. There's a lot of bad booze out there. I really appreciate the AA research workers who keep testing it for me. I don't think they're making it any better now than they ever made it. A lot of bad booze. In fact, I remember one time we drank at the Royal Hawaiian, which was close to the Disneyland up there. At a big circular bar, big circular bar. And at the Royal Hawaiian, you drink rum drinks. And I was really sick. And I thought, geez, that's a real rot gut rum they serve up there. I'm amazed at how awful that rum is that they serve up there. And then I thought, geez, they have all those people sitting at that bar. And just by looking at them, you knew they were there every night. How come they don't get sick with all that rot gut rum? And I thought, me and my keen alcoholic brain figured that out. They're alcoholics. They were alcoholics. And I'm not used to that because I'm used to good liquor. And I never went back to the Royal Hawaiian with all those alcoholics. I used to drink going to church dinner dances back in the pharmacy school. After I became a pharmacist, I worked in the neighborhood drugstore, family neighborhood drugstore, and you had to go to all the church functions, including the church dinner dances. You have to mix with people. I hate church dinner dances. A lot of people at church dinner dances. You have to talk to them. You have to do chit-chat. You have to do a lot of chit-chat at dinner. And you have to dance. You can't not dance at a church dinner dance. You can't, because every church dinner dance has at least one hyperactive woman. You're sitting there minding your own business, and they come running up to you, and she says, "Come on, Paul, let's dance." And you very politely say, "No, thank you. I can't dance." And they say, "Oh, sure you can," and drag you out on the floor and prove to the whole world that you can't dance, you know. I realize now, and looking back on in retrospect, I can see I'd have a few drinks before I would go to the church dinner dance, and it would relax me mentally and physically. Relax me mentally, and I could chit-chat. I could chit-chat. That was a good chit-chat, Really good chit-chat. It relaxed me physically, and I could dance. Today, I don't drink, and I don't dance. And, the trouble is, and again, in retrospect, I didn't know it at the time, but in retrospect, looking back on it, those two got out of sync. It would be like I hadn't even begun to relax mentally yet, and I get too relaxed physically. It might affect my speech. And I would talk funny. And so I would talk slowly and deliberately so nobody would notice, you know. I would trip when there was nothing to trip on, you know. I might even find myself lying there looking very serene, you know. And my mind is saying to me, get up, you fool. People will think you're drunk. And I say, what do you mean, get up? We're paralyzed from the ears down. You know? And I'd lay there and think, isn't that strange? I have never heard of anybody getting paralyzed from the ears down when they've had as little to drink as you have had. You must be allergic to this stuff. And I thought, I'll have to ask somebody about that someday. I was thinking of maybe some allergy professor or something, but I never found anybody to ask. Because they're liable to say, well, I don't know why it does that to you, but by God, if it did that to me, I wouldn't drink it anymore. You know? I didn't want to know what to do about it. I just want to know why it did that. You know? In fact, I could, I would lie there on the floor and I would be mentally leafing through the pages of Goodman and Gilman's textbook of pharmacology under alcohol poisoning, looking for paralysis from the ears down. You know? I never found it, but it was a practical problem to have because it took my mind off my full bladder. Okay. I don't remember ever being paralyzed from the neck down that I didn't also have a full bladder. One that absolutely refused to remain full. Then there'd be other times when I hadn't even begun to relax physically yet and I'd get too relaxed mentally. It'd be as if all my brain cells would get together and say, ah, oh, what the hell? He's drinking anyhow. Let's go home. And my brain cells, I'll go home, go to bed, my body would go on doing things. In the morning, I'd try to recall what my body had been doing when my brain was home in bed. And I never have figured out how to recall something that wasn't recorded at the time that it happened. I used to worry about that. I used to wonder, you know, what I had done during that time. But I quit thinking about that ever since I heard Cliff Varr from Oceanside said he used to spend a lot of time trying to figure out what he did during blackouts. Until one day he came to the realization that he never had come out of a blackout to find that he had spent the night helping the little sisters of the poor. So I quit trying to figure that one out. Anyhow, I ended up in the Nutwort. That's what I did. I had a couple of convulsions, and I knew I was getting sick. I knew I was having terrible headaches. I had a sense of impending insanity. I knew I was going crazy. I was losing weight. I had high blood pressure. I had ulcers. I had diarrhea. I had skin rashes. I had all kinds of goofy stuff. And I thought, geez, I need a good medical workup. I need a good diagnostician. Well, I happened to be the best diagnostician I knew. So I did some lab work on me, and I did a bit of a physical examination, and checked me over, and I sat down and had a consultation with me. And it was obvious. Convulsions, headaches, insanity coming on, and all this other stuff, it was obvious. I had a brain tumor. And I would die, and you'd all be sorry, by God. ha 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 yourself. I was under the care of the best neurologist in Orange County. And he was giving me Dilantin and phenobarbital. Is there really a bug on the wall, or is she just seeing that? Yeah. Oh, there really is a bug there? Yeah. All right. You're okay, kid. I was under the care of the best neurologist in Orange County, and he was treating me with Dilantin and phenobarbital for epilepsy. And he sent me back to the Mayo Clinic. And I thought, that's okay, they can find out I had a brain tumor and find out it was inoperable. And I'd die and you'd all be sorry, by God. And I was back there, then Max went and told him I was taking some pills that night, which was true, bless you. It was true. I didn't have a drinking problem, I had a sleeping problem. And I used to take a few things to help me get to sleep at night. And when I got back to get my reports from the last night, they said, well, there's one more thing we ought to do, I'd have you see our staff psychiatrist. I thought, that's a funny place to look for my brain tumor. But then I realized they had looked a lot of other funny places for my brain tumor. And, so I said, okay, I saw the psychiatrist, he locked me up in the local network. Now, Mayo Clinic's no doubt a good hospital, and it may even be a nice nut ward, I don't know. But don't go there at Christmas time. You go at Christmas time, they make you ice Christmas cookies. I remember the girl in white coming to my cell and taking me by the hand. We'd be down the hall to the Christmas cookie icing party. She would steer my hand in the icing and we'd smash it onto a cookie. I don't know how many of their damn cookies to be crumbled before I told them what they could do with their cookies. I signed out. I went back to California where they treat me with more respect, by God. The thing about the guys, there's nothing wrong with Christmas cookies, except I don't... When I was a little kid back in Alliance, Ohio, my older sister had a real thing about Christmas cookies. She had cookie cutters, and she had Christmas trees, Santas, angels, reindeers, all kinds of Christmassy cookie crap, and lots of icings and colors, and then all kinds of sprinkles to put on top, and we'd have a Christmas cookie icing contest. I did not like to ice Christmas cookies when I was a little kid back in Alliance, Ohio, and I did not like icing Christmas cookies when I was a big shot doctor on the nut ward of the Mayo Clinic. Then we went back to California where they treat me with more respect, by God. And got back there, and there they wanted me to make leather belts. They were fanatics on leather belts. It's really fun. It's part of the program. You can't graduate out of there until you make a leather belt. I'm sure if they had a Senate investigation, they'd find that there are people that have been there for years, and they won't let them out until they make a leather belt. Or an ashtray or something useful by God. I remember they tried to tell me that it would improve the quality of my life if I learned how to make leather belts. I didn't understand the philosophy, and besides, I didn't understand the instructions. Which wasn't my fault, that's the fault of that dumb occupational therapist, because I've always thought if you don't understand a thing well enough so you can explain it to me so I understand it, then you don't understand as well as you're supposed to. And she explained it to me 3 times, and I wasn't going to embarrass her by asking her a 4th time. And I remember sitting there in the nut ward, commiserating with myself. But the misdiagnoses and the poor medical management and the bad breaks, a nice guy like me in a place like that, you know. And while I'm thinking that, this dumb psychiatrist who can't see that my problems are strictly marital walked up behind me and wanted to know, would I be willing to talk to a man from Alcoholics Anonymous? And I thought, God Almighty, don't I have enough problems of my own? Without trying to help some drunk from AA, you know. I didn't even know anything about alcoholism, didn't want to know anything about alcoholism. The only thing I knew about alcoholics was if you treat one of them, they'll all start coming to you. And if they all start coming to you, your good patients will stop coming to you. But I could tell by the look on his face that he thought it was a good idea. And I don't know if you know that or not, but happiness on a nutwort is having a happy psychiatrist. So in order to make him happy, I said yes. And in no time at all, this clown comes galloping into the room yelling, "My name is Frank and I'm an alcoholic, ha 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 ha." I was embarrassed for him. I thought, my God, man, why don't you lower your voice? And these people think I'm a nut. Why don't we leave it at that? You know? And he told this story, and it was an interminable story. It went on and on and on and on, and I don't remember a word of it. All I remember is how it ended. He finally said, "Well, that's my story. I'm going to a meeting tonight. Would you like to go along?" So I said, "Hell no, I won't like it, but I'll go," because I knew he'd go back and squeal that dumb psychiatrist. And we went off to the meeting. I don't know what meeting we went to. I don't know how many meetings we went to before I knew what meeting I was at. But I know that it had a profound effect on the psychiatrist. It did. He had a change of personality. Now he's really interested in my case. He was ignoring me before that. Now he what's this about meetings? What's this about book? What other kind of meetings do they have? How often do you go to meetings? What do you go to meetings again? I thought, oh my God, I've got me an alcoholic psychiatrist. He's ashamed to go, so he's sending me, you know. So I was after Frank to take me every day. And Frank was good about that. He was going to take me every day, except he wasn't so sure about Friday. He thought on Friday he might have a date with his girlfriend, Carolyn. I thought, well, that's a hell of a way to run an organization. And I reported him to the psychiatrist, who got somebody else to take me on Friday night. And finally wound up Brownie Points, and I got discharged from the hospital. I had no intention of going back. Why would I go back? I wasn't an alcoholic. Problem was that Max liked the meetings. I'd say, "Let's go to a movie." She said, no, let's go to an AA meeting. She thought they were funnier, I guess. And once I found out she liked the meetings, I would threaten her. If she didn't shape up, by God, I wasn't going to go to AA anymore. That's the Al-Anons you hear laughing now. I said that once too often, that threatened her, and she did what she couldn't do. She got in the car and went to meeting by herself. She's not an alcoholic, and she couldn't drive the freeway. It was 45 minutes away to get to the meeting, because we couldn't go locally, for God's sake. We had to go as far as we could to get away, so we wouldn't run into anybody we knew. Yeah. Now we know everybody that goes to Laguna Beach, so they won't run into anybody they know. But she couldn't do that, but she drove the freeway, and she went to the meetings by herself. Have you ever tried that? Sitting at home on a Saturday night, drinking, while your non-alcoholic spouse is off laughing it up at an AA meeting? I thought it was very rude. I had to go back to the meetings to find out what the alcoholics were laughing about. And I thought it was awful. They laughed at things they ought to be ashamed of. Cried about things they ought to be laughing about. And it didn't make sense to me. But I kept going. It took 7 months. Went to meetings for 7 months. I went to one meeting too many. And I found myself laughing with them. And I haven't had a drink since. You know. And, the laughter has been a very important part of my recovery. In fact, I'm convinced that my higher power laughs every time he hears alcoholics laugh, even if he doesn't understand the joke. I heard things like, stick with the winners, stick with the winners. I don't hear it much anymore, but I heard, stick with the winners. And I thought, well, if I'm going to stick with the winners, I ought to know what a winner is. So I asked Chuck C. Oh, he was sober about 100 years at that time. And I said, what's a winner? And I was surprised when he hesitated before he answered. I had to think about it a minute, and he says, well, I guess you have to die sober. And I thought, die sober? I've never been at all interested in any accolades I could win by dying. I thought, well, in fact, I used to plan on being a saint. In fact, I did plan on it. I worked on it. Even got the copy of the Lives of the Saints, big thick book. I was reading the Lives of the Saints. They're going to pick out which one of the saints was going to be my role model, and I took it very seriously. And I'll tell you how seriously I took it. I had a humility belt. I had a leather belt about that wide, and I put thumbtacks through the belt with a point in, and you didn't use the belt to hold your trousers up, you put it against your skin under your clothes so the tacks went into you, and it would make you bleed, and you just feel the blood going down your legs, and if you left it on long enough, the blood accumulate in your shoes. You squish when you walked it. And I got a tremendous amount of humility out of that belt. I never wore it because it hurt, but it's. But I was sincere. So anyhow, I thought, well, okay, I won't be a winner if you have to die. It occurred to me, I was ashamed to be in AA. I was ashamed to have them out there know I was here. I was ashamed to have you know I was here. And your little chicken shit goals seem so insignificant. You know, I wanted to do big things. I mean, I've always been proud of my goals. And I remember at a meeting, a big, healthy, husky young buck stood at the podium and he said, if I don't drink today, I'm a success today. And I thought, oh my God. Big damn deal. He didn't have a beer all day long. I was disgusted that he, of course, that's the way you think when you're still drinking, you know. But somewhere along the line, I got the idea that if that's the bottom of the social barrel, and that's such a ridiculously low life goal, how come I can't do it? And how can I do anything else without that? That has to be the foundation for everything else. If it's so insignificant, minor, why don't you do it, fella? And I made the decision to become a successful member of AA, because it seems to me the world is divided into people who drink and people who don't drink. And the people who drink are divided into 9 out of 10 react to alcohol one way, and they're social drinkers. 1 out of 10 react to alcohol differently, and they're alcoholics. And of the alcoholics, there's two kinds. There's those that are practicing yet, and those that are recovering. And it seems to me that the recovering alcoholics are the ones that are having the most fun of all that big group of people. Right, right is right. And yeah, let's give that a hand. And I thought I'm gonna be a winner. I didn't make that claim to anybody else. Commitment. I made a commitment to myself. And over the years, I have periodically changed to some extent what I think a successful member of AA is. But essentially, I don't know any successful members who drink or take drugs. You know, and that seems to be the bottom line. And, I now haven't had a drink or drug in 31 years, and you're nowhere near as impressed as I am. I have not had a drink. I have not had a drink. Even when I deserved a drink. I have not had a drink when I wanted to drink. That's the way it is in AA. We don't drink. We don't drink no matter what happens. We don't drink. We don't drink no matter what doesn't happen. We just don't drink. No matter what, you know, we just don't. We don't drink. In fact, we're kind of noted for not drinking. I haven't even had an occasional mild social drink. And in fact, if I had, I don't think I'd be standing here with 31. The funny part of it is, you know, the funny parts about it, but I haven't had a drink in 31 years. And I'm not even thirsty. Yeah. Isn't that amazing? You know, when I was drinking, I was always thirsty. Nothing makes me want to drink like having a drink. You know, it doesn't make sense. The longer I stayed sober, the more I remembered how much of an alcoholic was. I was just hardly alcoholic at all when I first became alcoholic. But over the years, I've become much more alcoholic. I even had a little bit of a pill problem. I never became addicted to pills. I was not that bad. I never ever took a pill unless I had the symptom. Unless I had the precise symptom that only that pill would relieve. I either had it or I could feel it coming on. Every pill I ever took was medically indicated at the time. And prescribed by a doctor, and taken according to directions, my own. You know, and in fact, I know I wasn't addicted to pills because I never abused them. You ask any doctor how people get addicted to pills, they'll say you have to abuse the pill. You have to abuse the pill to get addicted to it. I don't even know how to abuse the pill. How do you abuse the pill? You stomp on the little thing. Talk mean to it, verbally abuse it, you dirty, rotten little pill, why don't you do what I told you? I was very solicitous of my pills. They were just little tiny things. I mean, you could, just to look at them, you could tell they were very mild. I was even very careful where I carried my pills. I used to carry them over here with my change. And people say, you got change for a dollar? And I say, oh yeah, and I go like that. And they say, oh, you carry second all and two and all around in the daytime, you know. I put it over with my keys, and I'd go out to the car and get in my car, and I'd take the keys out of my pocket. The Quaalude would run down the street, you know. The darn thing would always run faster than I could run, you know. And I didn't dare stomp on it, or I'd abuse it, you know. Anyhow, this is an AA meeting. We don't talk about drugs, so we must skip that. But I do want at least honorable mention to amphetamines. I don't know if I'd have had the physical stamina to have completed my pre-AA training period if it hadn't been for the amphetamines. They did have side effects, though. I mean, my mouth, I could spit dust. And affected my hearing, and I couldn't listen fast enough to hear what I was saying. I'm talking about the steps and the third step prayer. I love the third step prayer. In fact, we started a meeting back there. When I get bored, don't know what else to do. I think most people, I hardly ever, well, you just don't hear about people resigning from AA. I think, but what happens to them? And I think what happens, people get bored and drift away. And so I want to be very careful not to drift away. And when I get bored, I think of something to do. And one of the things I do is go and start a new meeting. Now I think, what kind of meeting would I like to have? And I'll just set up the format, find a place, get some friends. We'll go ahead and start the meeting. I've started maybe a dozen, 15 meetings. One of the meetings we started was a beat the clock meeting. And that's a different meeting, though. We're going to have a topic discussion meeting. And what we had was a one-hour topic discussion. It started at 7 o'clock, was over at 8. Then if you want to go to another meeting at 8:30, you could do that. But we got kind of a competition. We'd each week pick a different leader. The leader would pick a topic, and they'd see if they could get a topic with the most people that would come and participate. To be a good criteria for a good topic discussion meeting is how many people you get to share. And so we'd try to get a topic that everybody would want to share on. And so this one time, this gal was going to lead the meeting, and she said her topic was the bondage of self. And I thought, that's a dumb topic. She won't get anybody to share on that. Well, she did, and I didn't get to share. And I got to thinking about that bondage of self. In fact, I looked it up, and the bondage of self means the slavery of self-thinking. And I got to thinking about that, and I thought, you know, I am my favorite topic to think about. I really love to think about me, and what I'm doing, and what I've been doing, and what I wish I had done, and what I wish I hadn't done, and what I plan on doing, and I find me a fascinating topic. You guys are interesting, but you're nothing compared to me. The other thing was getting into that the steps. I had a hard time getting into the steps and pushing ahead on them. But you know, the third step is just a decision. You decide, yeah, that'd be a good idea to turn my will and my life over to the care of God. I think I'll do that. And then to follow up on that decision, you do your fourth step. My book says immediately and at once. But now, each step I've done has made the ones preceding it mean more to me. And so now, having gone through all of them, they're no longer like in steps, they're more like a circle, that each one adds to the others before and after it. And I kind of now combine the third step and the 11th step. So it becomes, I try living the decision of the third step. And I take the third step seriously in that the first time I did the third step, I recited the third step and the third step prayer on my knees in front of my sponsor. And I thought, that's a contract between me and God. But I thought, well, it'd be kind of easy for either one of us to weasel out of that. And how could we intensify that? And I thought, well, maybe if we had more witnesses, it would be harder to call all those witnesses together to cancel the contract. I don't know if that's true, but that's what I was thinking. And so I went before my then three home groups, and I recited the third step and the third step prayer, so that theoretically, if either one of us wanted to cancel a contract, we'd have to get all those witnesses together. And I felt a little better having done that. But then I got to thinking about, well, that's still a verbal contract. I'd like something in writing. So I went to a business supply store, and I bought a blank form for setting up a limited partnership. And I filled it out, and I gave my higher power a 51% controlling interest in my life. And he became the general partner, and I just the limited partner. And I felt good about that. But then there was one final thing that had to be added to that, because I realized all that shows is that a partnership exists. It doesn't show the terms of the partnership. It doesn't show who's responsible for what. So I got a piece of paper, drew a line down the middle. On one side, I put down what's God's responsibility. On the other side, what's my responsibility? And essentially, what it narrowed down to was that he's responsible for worry, and I'm responsible for work. And he doesn't like for me to even help him with the worry. And he never does a damn bit of the work. I tell him, I'll pedal and you steer, you know. And for God's sake, watch where you're going. But I don't like some of the places we've been, you know. And I work it on that deal. In fact, I feel that if I do a thing for the right motive and leave the results up to God, things turn out the way they're supposed to. May not be the way I would have wanted it, but it turns out to be the way it's supposed to be. The only thing I'm responsible for is my motive in what I'm about to do. And love is always the right motive. Love is always the right motive. And it used to be that what I was thinking now, I want you to do this, so I'll do this, and then you'll do what I want. But maybe you won't. Maybe I'll do something else. And I get manipulating and figuring out, maneuvering how to get you to do what I want you to do. And with this new system, it's so much simpler. I only have one half the equation, my side of it. I don't have to worry about how the outcome is. I'm not responsible for that at all. That's his responsibility. The only thing I'm responsible for is what's my motive and what's my attitude doing it. In fact, I think life is 90% attitude. And in fact, somebody said AA means altered attitudes. But love is always the right motive. I was reading something the other day, a long time ago, for some time. It goes back to the Course in Miracles and all that. People who know about such things said, there's really only two emotions. Really only two emotions, love and fear. And all other emotions are variations of one or the other. And I realized I had a fear-based life before the program. I did things because I was afraid not to. Or I didn't do things I wanted to do and knew I should do because I was afraid to do them. And now it's trying to have a love-based life. Which reminds me, Max and I, this December the 2nd, Max and I, it was our 59th wedding anniversary. You're nowhere near as impressed as I am. And I'm not even as impressed as Max is. And we decided that for this 60th year of our anniversary, we were going to make it the best year of our lives. And for instance, no bringing up the past. No, how come you always? Or how come you never? Or you're always doing this, you never do. And no complaining about the other, no criticizing, condemning, or complaining. And not even telling the other person wrong, even when they are. Don't even point it out. And it isn't, you know, after 59 years of me not being able to shape Max up, I might as well give up, you know. But so far we've been succeeding in that, which it was focusing on our communication skills and that. I gave Max a written statement of emotional independence. I wrote it out saying to her, as of that date, from that day forward, she was no longer responsible for how I felt. That I couldn't say, you made me angry, for instance. I could say, whatever you did, I chose to get angry about it. But my emotions are my choice, my responsibilities, not her. I can't, it's strange for me to be able to say that because she drove me to drink for 28 years. And I finally given her freedom, and my emotions are my responsibility, not hers. Judith liked to watch her watch and said it didn't mean anything, because she was going to talk as long as she was going to talk, or and she said Dale did that. But when I looked at my watch, it means nothing, because I didn't notice to see what time I started. So it really doesn't mean anything. What?
Started about 9.
About 9? Yeah. Thank you very much. You can get me in a lot of trouble. I need to stop. I hate to stop because I love talking to you. I could talk forever, but I'm not going to. But I was thinking one night, what would a graph of my life look like? I just saw a computer program where you can put statistics into the computer, and with the program would make a graph of it. And I thought, what would a graph of my life look like if I had a giant computer and could put all the facts in there? And I came to the conclusion that it would be a giant V, like the Jelinek chart, actually. That my life started 80 years ago over there. Speaking of the fact that I'm 80 years old, that's my bragging story. Not that I'm 80, but this has nothing to do with AA now, so if you're new, don't pay attention. But I won't charge for it because it's not AA. I am, as far as I know, the only 80-year-old who has worn out his treadmill before it wore him out. Four and a half years ago, I bought a treadmill, and I don't believe much in service contracts, but I thought, treadmill, a lot of moving parts, I think I'll get a service contract. So I got a service contract. Well, I wore out the tread, and they replaced it. I wore out the main bearing, and they replaced it. I wore out some other parts, and they replaced it. Finally, the company that made the treadmill went out of business. Well, that didn't put my service contract out of business. So they said, well, you go back to Montgomery Ward, you pick out the best treadmill you can find, we'll pick it up and deliver it, and pick up the old one, take it away, and we'll set it up for you. And I am now in the process of trying to wear out my second treadmill. And I spend 40 minutes on it every morning. And what it does for me, it's, I don't do it so that it'll improve my general health. I don't care if it makes me live 6 months longer. What I use it for is it helps me to not get depressed. It's my personal Prozac. It prevents depression in that. It works very well for me. Although I must say, I do love depression. I think depression has a lot of redeeming social value. It does for me. I mean, you take all the problems in the world and gather them all up and throw them all away to narrow down to just one problem, me. You know, me, poor little me. And in fact, I have a little trouble distinguishing between depression and self-pity when it comes to me. I love this, the exercise thing. I can hardly wait to get home to get my treadmill and my little Aladog. Dog. The graph. I was born 80 years ago. And from then until July 31st, 1967, my life was on a downhill course. Now, it wasn't a straight line down. It was up and down, just enough ups to keep me confused. And every time it went up, then it went downer than it was before the last time it went up. And it ended up in the nut wart of the hospital I was on the staff of. But that wasn't bad enough. I had to go to AA. And so I went to AA for 7 months, went to one meeting too many, and I turned into a very mild alcoholic. I accepted the fact that I, of all people, strange as it might seem, and even though I had no choice in the matter, had nothing to do with it, I had a disease that came from nowhere, and I was an alcoholic and a mild one. And from that point on, my life's been getting better and better and better. Again, it's not a straight line up. It's up and down, up and down, up and down. And when it goes down, there are all kinds of things I can do to get it to go back up. And go to more meetings, start another meeting, read the book, call some newcomers, get some people to sponsor, and get busy. There's just all kinds of things. Carry the message. And there's millions of ways to carry the message, and at least thousands. And or if nothing else, just sit still and hurt. I mean, that's the only Bible quote I use. The Bible says, and it came to pass. Bible doesn't say, and it came to stay. You know, you sit still and hurt, it'll get better. And I'm fairly convinced when people like us, when people like us hurt, we either drink or grow. And we either drink or grow, because if we don't drink, we grow. And if we do drink, we go backwards. So we never end up the same after a painful episode. We're either better off or worse off, is what I was trying to say. And that as long as we don't drink, all pain then becomes growing pain, because we're better off when we get through it. And my life now is better than it's ever been. This is the best life I've ever known. Best life I've ever known. And it keeps getting better. It gets better and worse, but it keeps getting better. And the only, as far as I can tell, the only thing that determines how high that can go on this side is how long I can stay around doing the things I'm doing that's keeping it on an uphill curve. And another thing, I'm convinced that I can't get it all. I'm convinced that nobody can live long enough to get all this program has to offer. There's so much more to this program than not drinking. Just this tremendous, so much, much more than just not drinking. I mean, but nothing happens as long as you're drinking. Yes, abstinence is not the answer, but nothing happens without abstinence. And so I'm going to keep on doing what I'm doing to keep it on an uphill curve. What really fascinates me is the crux of the V. The one little act of acceptance of just that one single fact changed the course of my life from getting progressively worse to getting progressively better. Well, as smart as I am and as good looking, what took me so goddamn long to accept that simple, obvious fact? My neighbors all knew that I was an alcoholic. A lot of people knew I was an alcoholic. How could I not know I was an alcoholic? The way I see it is I was confusing acceptance with approval. I thought, if I accept this, people will think I approve of being an alcoholic. And I didn't approve of being an alcoholic. I never intended to be an alcoholic. I don't even look like an alcoholic. Except sometimes when I'm drinking. Because I didn't approve of being an alcoholic, I couldn't accept that I was an alcoholic, and because I couldn't accept that I had an alcoholic, there was nothing I could do about it. But acceptance of an intolerable situation is empowering, because once you accept the situation, then you have choices, then there are things you could do about it. And it was very relieving for me to accept the situation. And acceptance didn't come before, I mean approval didn't come before acceptance, it came subsequent to that. And today I thoroughly approve of me being an alcoholic. I like being an alcoholic. I'm glad to be an alcoholic. And if it bothers you to hear me say that, that's too damn bad. It's just the way it's supposed to be. I was ashamed, as I said earlier, I was ashamed to be an alcoholic, ashamed to be here, and today I'm proud. I'm proud. I'm mighty, mighty, mighty proud to be a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous. It's one of the greatest things of my life. And I thank God for AA, and I thank you and AA for my sobriety. Thanks for having us here, and have a great weekend.